Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Which brings us to Rhea.
Yeah, we were best of friends. She was going to school, or she was working up in Ogden at the time, and I had left BYU. I moved up to Ogden, went to a singles ward there attached to Weber State College, and I lived in a place there were four of us, and we were definitely... Yeah, we were noticed in the singles ward there. And Rhea lived up in Ogden, and it was, you know, somewhere around that time or shortly thereafter that eventually we started dating.
Okay.
Now, I had loved Rhea since high school. She was a wonderful friend. She was a confidant, though she didn't know, again, that hidden side of me. We had genuine fun together. We just clicked. And I knew that if I was going to make this work with anybody, it would be with my best friend. When it comes right down to it, I used her and took advantage of her in that respect because she did not know. I knew she did not know.
As a lot of women and some men, in this era, in this time.
Right.
And so you went in, I believe, in good faith, believing that you'd be able to take care of this and that you could have a successful marriage.
Yes. We were dating. And then, of course, I was at this time struggling with what in the world am I going to be when I grow up? I thought that I needed to find from God my one direction, my niche in life, and that there was something that he wanted me to do, and I needed to know what I needed to study to become, because there was something that God wanted me to be.
Sure.
I couldn't figure that out for the life of me. My sister-in-law worked for a court reporter. I had no clue what a court reporter was. But she said, you really need to look into court reporting because for many different reasons, but one of which was you could complete the training and the education to become a court reporter in a 2.5-3 year time span, depending, and you can make a good income and you can have flexibility. So if you decide to pursue something else, you can still work. That seemed attractive to me, and I looked into it. There were no schools in the Utah area, and I looked at different schools. The one that I decided upon that I wanted to look at firsthand was in Southern California. I talked to my parents. I said, I need to go look at this school. Can you put me on a plane? They did. I went down and looked at the school. I knew that that's where I was going to go. Rhea and I had discussed marriage before this. She had said no.
Oh, she didn't.
She didn't say absolutely no. She just said, we have to think about this or whatever. And we had kind of broken off those kind of talks.
Okay.
And I'm down in Southern California. I'm now removed from what I thought was living within the bubble when you're in Utah. I was outside of the bubble. I didn't have the insulation of the church around me. I was down in wicked Southern California. I knew that if I moved down there by myself, I wouldn't make it. And I called her from the motel that I was staying in Southern California and asked her to marry me over the telephone.
Yes. Okay. So that makes sense to me now, because when she said that you proposed to her over the telephone, I was like, oh, wow. You know, that's not very romantic, you know? On the other hand, it would say, hey, I really want to do this. But for you, it makes a lot of sense now because you're feeling like you're in Babylon here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're desperate, really.
Right.
And so you actually propose to her over the phone.
Right.
And what does she say?
She said yes.
She says yes.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your feelings?
I was elated because now the door, well, it was light at the end of the tunnel, if I can use that. I knew someone that I genuinely loved, that I had known for years. I knew that there was compatibility that way. And I wanted to have a life with her. And so I flew home from Southern California very happy, thinking that, okay, you know, I'm closing this other door. I'm making this choice. I've opened this door. I'm going to step through and all will be well. And I can't remember the time frame when I was down in California, but came home. We set a date and we were married that July of 1975.
And I can't remember, where'd you guys get married?
In the Ogden Temple.
So it's a great occasion. You're happy. She's happy. And then I asked her this question, and I've got to follow up with you because, you know, because I'm thinking about the honeymoon. So I'm asking her about physical intimacy.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is not something I haven't thought about because I never had an issue responding to Rhea. She's the only female that I ever had that kind of, well, success with. But I think it is so tied to my emotional attraction and connection with her that this was just a natural expression of my love. But yeah, it was great. Never any complaints in that area.
So for you, you're saying the fact that you guys were best friends and the fact that there was this emotional friendship and bond with Rhea, that that's what made it helpful or possible for you to be able to have that kind of relationship with her.
Right. And that would prove, I think, for both of us to be a very double-edged sword, because for me, it was the exact opposite of the experience in Rome. I wasn't anymore standing in front of a mirror screaming at myself, calling myself a faggot. I was performing. And so I'm going, aha.
This is working.
This can happen. This is working.
Do you think at that point that maybe you had made a mistake, that maybe you're bisexual?
I've thought about that. But then again, since my attraction to the opposite sex has been limited to one individual, I don't think I would qualify. If there's a Kinsey scale for bisexuals, I'm not very high on the scale.
Okay.
Because it was a unique experience. And I don't know how you separate out the emotional connection. And I want this to work so badly. And I love this person. And yes, it's working. And so it was reinforcement to me. And I think later on, that would prove a real stumbling block for Rhea, because she struggled with the, and it took years and years and years for her to come to the position that homosexuality is not a choice.
Right.
And I think our success in that realm
made it more difficult.
Yeah, exactly. For her. Because she could say, well, it worked. You obviously can change. You obviously can function. You know,
right.
That would eventually lead to her really heaping upon herself self-recriminations and guilt. If she had only done this, if she had only done that, if she hadn't impeded my progress by doing such and such, that it could have been a success.
Right, which a lot of straight spouses, that's common for them, that they feel like if it's not working, then they're the ones to blame and blame the other too. It's such a heart-wrenching experience to be in. So let's move forward from that then. So you're able to perform and you guys start having children.
Yes.
And this is your dream, you know, you wanted to have kids.
Yeah, this is our dream and my dream. And for many reasons, it was very unwise for us to start having children as soon as we did, because we were absolutely unprepared financially for it. I had just started school, but we didn't believe in birth control. Rhea became pregnant and miscarried the first time. I think probably there was some thinking there that, yeah, maybe it's not so wise for us to have children right away. But also she was told that it would be very difficult for her to conceive. And so we were not using any kind of birth control, any protections, and felt that, okay, fine, we don't have to worry. And then she became pregnant with our first daughter, Mikkel, who was born in 1976. Very, very excited about having a baby. Very excited to welcome Mikkel into our lives. And for me, I was going to school. I was on a career course through education. We were the vibrant, young, attractive couple in the ward in California, and it all looked great. But then the roller coaster emotional thing started with me again. It started slowly, but took a few years, not until after the birth of our second daughter, when it came to a head, when Rhea couldn't take the, you know, the roller coaster effect anymore, because I would be on highs and then I would be on those lows again. She knew something was going on. I think she thought I was having an affair at one point. But what was happening was I would be going about my regular life and then I would walk past someone. I would see someone. I would be attracted to them. And then the thought process, I would have fantasies, and that would send me into this downward spiral of guilt. And then I would go through this repentance phase and through these mind control efforts to control that thought process, the fantasizing. And it would cause me to go into depressions. I mean, not clinical depressions as you might think of them, but she knew and recognized the mood swings.
Did you ever, you know, it's not uncommon for a lot of gay individuals to have suicidal thoughts, often because of, you know, lack of acceptance and the self-hatred that is built up through mm-hmm. the various messages that they receive, the self-loathing. It mutates into more and more severe mood swings and depression. Did you ever feel suicidal?
Yeah, I had periods of suicidal ideations, and there was, of course, this was later on. By this time, we had Emily was in the family, the third daughter, and we were back in California. There was a school nearby, as I recall, and I used to go up there and walk the track for exercise and just to try and clear my head. But there was one time when I was in at the bottom of that roller coaster hill, and this might come across as overly dramatic, but if I had had access to a gun, I would have killed myself that night. I couldn't take the struggle. This Jekyll and Hyde battle was, I was losing it, and the evil part was becoming stronger, and I couldn't fight it, and I didn't want to fight it anymore, and I was tired, and I felt so useless and so worthless. And because, you know, one of the natural consequences of that kind of thinking is I had absolutely no self-esteem. That translated into, you know, I had employment problems. We had money problems. All of this was, I can't help but think that this was all inextricably tied. And I had one person describe it one time as, I simply would not allow myself to be a success in anything, and that I was on a self-destructive path, not just physical self-destruction, but I was on an emotional and spiritual self-destructive path, and I was doing it deliberately.
And you feel this self-sabotage and self-destruction and some of the financial problems and career problems, you feel that there's a definite connection to the pretense of being straight, when in reality you really see the Mr. Hyde and the Dr. Jekyll, and the battle is just ongoing between these two sides, and it's having an effect not only on how you feel about yourself, but it's also having an effect on your behavior. And you really feel that that's connected in terms of the struggles you had with work and money problems and things like that.
Yeah, because I felt, as I often told Bria later on, this was my choice. You were my choice. I'm here. I have to stay. I have to do this. But that in and of itself at times became a prison because I felt I had no way out. And I look at the lives I am in the process of destroying and look at the lie that I have perpetrated with this person that I love, the mother of my children. And how can you be such a vile individual to do this? And you are an absolute piece of garbage for what you have done, and there's no way to get away from it.
So as time goes on in the marriage, as more years pass, as you have more children, you hate yourself even more.
Right. And by this time, Rhea is aware of what is really going on, because we were at a family reunion, her side of the family, in Colorado in 1978. Marin was just a baby, second daughter. And I was in one of the lows of the roller coaster, and we went on a walk, and she pinned me down. She said, "Curtis, you've got to tell me. Something is going on. I know something is wrong. I know something is happening. You have got to tell me what's going on. What is the matter?" And so I told her. And nothing against Rhea would have been a natural reaction, but a change came over her face, and I saw this look of horror in her eyes. And in many respects, that day I lost my best friend. This couldn't have been anything other than a huge betrayal to her. She has described it as, this, in an instant, made everything a lie. And that would be a horrible moment. I mean, it was difficult. Yes, for the first time, I am telling someone, I'm breaking down that huge, thick wall I had built around my inner self, and I'm letting someone in that part of me.
For the very first time in your life.
For the very first time, other than some confessions, but it hadn't been to that degree.
You had made some confessions, you'd worked in therapy, but this was a real life situation here.
She was in
shock.
She was in shock, and the way I viewed it, she was my life raft, and I had, in telling her this and seeing the reaction, I had reached over and punctured the side of the life raft, and now everything was sinking.
Wow. That's a huge metaphor there.
Yeah, exactly. After that initial adjustment period, when she gathered this resolve that, yeah, she was in this battle, we were going to stay in it together, we were going to make this work, then we started to work very diligently together. I am sabotaging that over and over again, but yeah, we were working very diligently to make things right. We're going to go into a phase here now where there's more.
There's some tough stuff here coming up.
Yeah, because we're going into cheating,
right?
Confessions, now direct confessions to the church, excommunication, public humiliation, or church humiliation. This is another, you know, now we're into a fork in the road and life altering part.
Yeah.
You know, there'd been this over and over, you know, I keep calling it the roller coaster, but then it, despite the resolve and despite all of the efforts and whatnot, I just failed. And yeah, some people would say I gave in to temptation, Satan took over, whatever. Yeah, I gave in to the impulses and the temptations or the inclinations, however you want to couch it. And I was unfaithful to my wife and engaged in homosexual activity. That eventually, as I've talked to before when I would have just the thought processes and then feel the guilt and go through the repentance process. This only made that much more compelling and poignant. And so, I ended up in a church court. I confessed to the bishop and then was brought up under church discipline and subjected to a church court.
And what was that like?
I've had some humiliating, soul-draining experiences before, but this one tops it. We go into a room at the steakhouse, the steak center, and they've got the steak presidency is sitting behind a table. They've got the tables in a U formation. The entire high council is surrounding me, you know, on both sides, and then the stake presidency in front of me. The stake president proceeds to rehearse everything that I have through the course of some protracted confessional sessions revealed. And these are men that I have served with, I've gone to church with, I've shared moments with, and they're hearing what can only be described as the basest details of my entire life. And it didn't just, I mean, it went all the way back.
All the way back.
All the way back.
So, and we're talking, when you say detail, we're talking explicit, graphic detail?
In some respects, yes. I could literally feel myself shrinking in that chair. First of all, I'm placed in the middle of them. You know, you feel their presence. They're right there. You can feel them. You know, some of them, probably their eyes are burning into me. Others are averting their eyes, not wanting to acknowledge that I'm there. It was just, it was a horrible, horrible experience.
Some of them, your friends in the room?
Yes. Yes. People that I knew, I'd known for some time. You know, when they finished rehearsing this whole sordid tale, it's the only way I can describe it. You know, I guess they excused me. I went out of the room while they...
They deliberate then. And
they deliberate. And
discuss.
Yeah. And then they invited me back in. And
how long did they discuss? How long were you out of the room for?
I don't know. It may have been 20 minutes. Couldn't have been much longer because they didn't have much to deliberate. There wasn't much to debate. I mean, the law of the church was pretty much set in stone. I was a Melchizedek priesthood holder. I had been in the elders' quorum presidency.
You've been to the temple. Endowment. You were married.
Yeah. And I had broken all of those vows. And I knew that there was no other choice for them. There was not going to be any other decision. I knew it wasn't going to be a disfellowshipping. And so, you know, they invite me back into the room. They deliver the verdict, so to speak, and proceed to excommunicate me. I don't know what they said. I don't know if there's a prescribed verse of condemnation. I don't know. I just know that I left that room excommunicated.
Which is what you expected.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Yeah, it did not come as any surprise. What came as a surprise was my feelings as I was walking down the hallway to leave the steakhouse. I was, I think, more angry than I have ever been in my life.
What's going through your mind?
I was so bitterly angry because, I don't know, I felt that I had been lied to by my church, by the people within the church, that this was going to be, you know, that my course was set. You know, at this point, I'm far away from ascribing any guilt to myself here. I'm just blaming. You told me this. You said this. You said I would do this. I could do this. It didn't work. Everything has been a failure. And I was just so bitterly angry, and I remember walking down that hallway going, I will get back in. I will do everything within my power to get back in just so I can leave on my terms and I can kick you out of my life. That was my feeling at the moment.
Okay.
That would change. But yeah, that's how I felt at the moment. I wouldn't want anyone to ever go through that experience. I went to church. That was a Saturday night, I believe. I went to church that Sunday. I was in priesthood meeting. I knew that they were going to announce it. And I was there. I sat off by myself, knowing what was going to be said. And I can't remember his name. One of the members of the bishopric, one of the counselors, he came down and sat by me. And he held my hand as the bishop announced that I had been excommunicated.
So this is in general opening exercises in priesthood.
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the counselors comes down and actually sits beside you and holds your hand.
Yes.
Yes. What did that mean to you?
I thought that was a wonderful gesture because, again, I felt like I was... It was the same feeling I had when I was sitting in the tabernacle back when I was 12 years old. I felt utterly alone. I felt utterly shamed. And I felt every, though not physically, every eye was on me at that very moment.
Yeah. And it was in it this was. Case. In this yeah. case.
Right.
Were you warned ahead of time that he was going to announce this?
Yes. I knew that was the process.
Okay.
I knew that happened.
But nonetheless, shameful, humiliating experience.
Yeah. You know? And I cannot imagine what Rhea went through that day because that kind of news spreads like wildfire. And by the time Sunday school and sacrament meeting were going on, the whole ward knew.
And because they only know that you're excommunicated, they, of course, are, it's natural to speculate what the reason for the excommunication might be.
Right. And I don't have any inkling that the details were known by anybody. I know... unless Rhea confided in some of her very close friends there, I don't think anyone knew. I think the assumption was that I had had an extramarital affair, and that was it.
So you believe the stake presidency and the High Council kept confidentiality in this case, then?
I have no reason or anything to point to that would lead me to believe any differently. That was not the case back in Utah, but there in California, I don't know that that happened at all.
Okay. So. Okay.
But anyway, at that point, I set out on a path of hyperactivity. And this time it wasn't, I mean, I had gone past the, I'm going to get back in just so I can kick you out. That's not what was going on in my mind now. I wanted to get back in the church. In this time frame, when my first son, Nathan, was born, and he was the first child, you know, that wasn't born in the covenant, and I felt I owed him that he would not be singled out as the only child in the family, not sealed to his mother and father.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to get back to the temple so that my son...
would be Nathan. Sealed to both of you.
Yes. Even though, I mean, I can't say enough how much I love my daughters, but my son Nathan was the answer to the prayer I uttered while sitting in that rocking chair in Milano, Italy, holding that little boy.
Okay.
And praying for a son.
Okay.
And I wanted him sealed to us. And so... we started, and this was a period of, when I say hyperactivity, I mean hyperactivity. We didn't have family home evening. We had family time every single morning, getting up, praying, reading the scriptures, having the little girls memorize scripture, teaching gospel lessons.
You are in ultra-Orthodox mode here.
Yes, yes. I knew that I mean, the minimum amount of time was 1 year before you could apply for rebaptism, and I was going to do it within the shortest period of time possible.
Okay.
It was also during that period of hyper-conformity, hyper-activity, that I really started on my study, deep study, of church doctrine and church history, which would eventually signal the end of my belief in the church.
Okay.
I think part of my mind, I knew what I was doing. I was telling myself, I'm just looking for deeper understanding, deeper appreciation for the depths of the gospel and the doctrine. And I wanted to understand more. I wanted to know more. But at the same time, and this was all with the aim of strengthening myself, strengthening me. But in all honesty, this is when I started to look for I started to want to disprove. That's probably the way to look at it. I was going to find out everything. And I became fascinated with people who had left the church, who had become what, you know, I would have at one point termed as rabid anti-Mormons. There was a group, very active group in Southern California called Ex-Mormons for Jesus. I became acquainted with them, I asked for permission to come and interview them at one of their meetings. I think Rhea never forgave me for carting her off to that meeting. I don't think she was ever more uncomfortable in her life than being in that meeting with this group of ex-Mormons. But I interviewed them and talked to them, asked them of their experiences. I later on made the mistake after I ran into one of them in public. I thanked them for the opportunity and that I was actually going to be telling of my experiences in a sacrament meeting talk. This was after I had obviously been rebaptized. And I think I jumped ahead a little bit there. There was a whole group of them that showed up to sacrament meeting that day that I delivered my sermon, my talk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, that was kind of a sidetrack. But I really delved into the doctrine and the history of the church at that period of time.
Gotcha. So you got rebaptized.
Yes.
Probably kind of a little bit before that.
Oh, yeah.
And then comes the point where the marriage really is on the line here.
Right. We continued in this cycle. I continued in this cycle of great expectations, great hopes, and then failures when it came to work. I left my schooling prematurely because I knew that Rhea wanted to get out of California, wanted to go back to Utah. And that's where I wanted to end up as well. But I thought that I would be okay. I had a job offer at a court reporting agency in Salt Lake City if I could pass my test. So I went on a concerted effort to finish my schooling. I quit work. My parents supported us for a while I went to school, continuing school full time, but without working. Because I'd gone through a period of time where I was working a graveyard shift and then going to school full time during the day. That was a horrible, horrible time.
Yeah.
But this was our hope that we would move back to Utah. I would pass my certification test and I would begin work. That didn't work. It didn't work out that way. Financially, we were under stress. The marriage was under stress because of that. I was back again now because of these failures in a cycle of overwhelming hope and giddiness almost that, we're going to be successful. And then having something tempt me, having the thought processes start again and realize that I was really no further along in the course, in the path, and that this was just a never-ending battle and I just wasn't going to win it.
So it came to the point where you were feeling like you were spinning your wheels, basically.
Spinning my wheels, and I think it just came to a point where Rhea, she had no more strength to deal with this anymore.
It almost sounds like you both are just emotionally, physically and spiritually exhausted.
Yeah. I mean, it came to this point when, I mean, we'd been going through a horrible cycle and we'd had a fight and we were standing in the kitchen of our home in Fruit Heights. And she said, I want a divorce. And I said, I do too. I don't love you anymore. I remember the hurt on her face when I said those words. And I still remember the look on her face. It was over at that point.
Now, Rhea, in her interview, one issue that was big for her is you and her had discussed your affair. Mm-hmm. And she had some concerns about whether you used, in her words, protection.
Right.
And she felt like you had initially had said that you had. And this is when AIDS was really coming to the forefront.
Right.
You know, in the 80s. And then later on, she asked the question again and clarified and got the answer that she did not want, which was that you didn't. And for her, that was a scary moment.
Yeah, she, I think, was feeling extremely vulnerable. And we have some differing memories as to how the questions were asked, how they were answered. But what it comes down to is, in many respects, I was extremely reckless. I didn't put, when it comes right down to it, I discarded my concern for my family and for my wife and put my own needs and wants ahead of them. I did it multiple times, and that was reckless. I endangered them in many respects. I endangered them emotionally, financially, and yes, despite and in spite of any protections I could have or did not take, there was always a possibility that, yeah, I could have introduced that kind of element, a deadly disease, to someone who was an innocent. And I think that worry, she had no reason to trust me. I think at that point, she didn't feel safe. I don't blame her.
In our remaining time, mm-hmm. I want to come through this and talk about where you're at now in your life.
Yeah.
Has life gotten better for you? Obviously, so many good times with Rhea. You love your children, but just so many difficult moments and just dealing with reconciling your orientation.
Yeah.
As you go through this, where are you at now? And tell us, have things gotten a little bit better for you?
Well, to echo the television ads, things do get better. It gets better. There has been an amazing transformation in not only my immediate family, my children, my ex-wife, her family, but my family, my siblings, my parents. It has gone from, well, I'll just say it this way. My parents were much more progressive than my siblings were. When after the divorce, there was the divorce, and then I was just thrown out of the closet. You know, this all came at the same time. People found out that we were getting divorced and that I was gay all at the same time. Now, that was a lot to deal with. But
yeah,
and it was a shock to many people. And again, we're back in our hometown. We're in Kaysville. But my parents, it took a while before I would still acknowledge and tell them and talk with them. But they progressed. A few years later, when I was with my first partner, they actually got to the point where they would interact. They would come to our home. He would go with me out to my parents' home. We would eat dinner together. But it was understood and it was expressly stated, he's not welcome at family gatherings. That created a huge rift between my siblings and I. But that changed over time. I didn't know how much until years later, but my second brother was dying of cancer, and I had gone out to say my goodbyes. And I sat in that hospital room with my sister-in-law, and she took my hand and she said, you know, Kurt, I had a conversation with your father the other day and I asked him why they, the family, had done what they did and why did they react the way they had and why had they basically driven me from Utah. And he had said to her, I don't know, I wish I could take it all back. And she sat there, we're in the room where her husband is dying, and she's apologizing to me for the way that my family had treated me. You fast forward that to 2008. My siblings come back to visit me in Maryland, and they're invited, all of them, to my dear friends, John and Mike, their home for dinner. Now, John and Mike had taken me in and taken care of me when I was recovering from my aneurysm. They are the ones responsible for saving my life. We pull up to their house, knock on the door, we walk in. I introduce them to my family. And my brother, without hesitation, takes John in his arms and hugs him and kisses him on his cheek and says, thank you for taking care of my little brother. That was a major change from the way it had been just a few years before.
You probably had always hoped for that.
That's what I had wanted, yes.
That's what you had hoped for, and there it was.
There it was, and it was amazing to me. My brother and my sisters, we were talking openly about something. You know, it was the rule in my family that we didn't discuss politics. We didn't discuss my personal life. And so things stayed on kind of an even keel without recognizing all of the subtext. But now it was open. I was unapologetic. I had no reason to apologize. This is who I am. This is my life. And we were not at odds anymore.
So there's love and there's reconciliation.
There is, because years before, when I'd had a confrontation with my sister, she told me, she said, Kurt, if we accept you, then we will lose you.
What do you think that meant?
She meant we could not accept your gay, quote, lifestyle. We cannot recognize your partner, who I'd been with for years. Because if we recognize that, then you will take that as being, it's okay, and you'll stop fighting to change, and we'll lose you in eternity. So it had changed entirely from that.
What do you think changed their minds?
Time, and probably in many respects, just realizing the futility of their hopes that I was ever going to change. Because I certainly wasn't going to, and I had gone way beyond the path of trying to change. I had openly left the church. I was openly out and gay, and they knew it. And plus, you know, at this point, I'm in my 50s. What the hell are they going to do? You know, so it just.
So they accepted it.
They did. They did. And it was a marvelous change. And, you know, on Rhea's side of the family, that was never an issue. They were always caring, you know, with one glaring exception with a family member. But I always felt nothing but acceptance. And we didn't, again, talk religion. We didn't talk my personal life, my sexual life, all of that kind of stuff. But I never felt them, you know, turning their backs on me, to their credit. They never did that. But so my world in that respect has changed. My children and Rhea, where there was definite opposition, there were some really dicey moments. There were times when, of course, the kids lived in Texas with Rhea at this time. Visitation was an issue because it was understood they were certainly not going to go to my house where I lived with my partner. But a side benefit from that was that we spent an awful lot of time at my parents' house. And so my parents' home became a second home to my children, and they became very close to my parents. Those were great times. But my children have changed from being outwardly antagonistic, which my youngest daughter, Emily, was. She thought I was definitely going to hell, and she didn't hold back in basically letting me know that was her thought. To my sons, Nathan and Jefferson, who had made a pact between themselves that they were going to get me back on the straight and narrow and back into the church, point out the error of my ways and bring me back into the fold. To the point where my two sons live in Austin. After I moved down here, my sons wanted me to be in Austin because they were going to march in the Gay Pride Parade and they wanted their father there with them. And we marched together in the Austin Gay Pride Parade.
When was that?
That was this last year.
This past year?
This past year. Two amazing things. I mean, Jefferson is a writer and a blogger, and you're aware of that. And he's written some amazing blogs about the experience. He was published, he works for Wells Fargo. He's a personal banker for Wells Fargo. And during June, their Pride Awareness Month, his article was published about his relationship and how he had changed from trying to change his father to accepting and loving his father. And so that's all changed. I'm close to my children. There's not the walls, they're not the barriers that there once were. And I'm happy.
I have one last question. Mm-hmm. Actually, I may have two questions left. One is, are you still friends with Rhea?
Oh, definitely. I love her. I love her husband. I call him Saint Dave.
And he's active in the church, right?
He is.
And how does he view you and treat you and interact with you?
He's a wonderful man. He's always been gracious and friendly. But, you know, Rhea and I, our relationship dates back to junior high. And just with a few sometimes very nasty bumps in the road, we've always loved each other. And we'll always love each other.
Yeah. All right. With Mormon Stories, we kind of do almost like a testimony at the end where you share your truth or what you believe. But I kind of want to change it just a little bit since today is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, even though people won't be hearing this on that day. But I'm just a big fan of him and just think that he was an incredible transformational figure that brought a new measure of equality and civil rights and human rights to the United States. So my final question for you, Curtis, is do you have a dream? Where do you see things going from here for LGBT individuals? Are you able to be at the mountaintop to be able to see the promised land, as Dr. King said in his famous speech?
Well, almost as much change has taken place if we look at who was just had their second inaugural and on whose celebratory day, the day of the I Have a Dream speech, who would have thought that short time period ago,
50 years ago,
that we would be inaugurating for a second time an African-American president. Still, you know, the racial situation in this country has a long way to go, but who would have thought back then? Likewise, who would have thought, looking back at the time period when I was a young boy in small town Utah, that not that many years into the future, I would see gay couples being married legally, that I would see the openness. And I mean, I'm here in Texas. I'm not too far from the buckle of the Bible Belt. And you can go to Austin, you can go to Dallas, and things are just open and unreserved. And it is a new world. We're not at the mountaintop. We're not as far as we can go, but It is oh so different from the days when you had to have secret knocks to get into bars and hanky codes to be able to identify fellow gay people. It's a different world. And the main thing is the attitudes and the perceptions of society in general are changing, and you especially generationally, because you talk to younger people, it's not an issue for them. And so give it another generation and it will have another quantum leap forward. So people just take heart in that, because there has been tremendous progress and there will continue to be. And it does get better.
Curtis, thank you so much for being on Gay Mormon Stories. I can't tell you what a privilege it has been to be able to really share your story and to be able to hear you discuss your story and the highs and the lows. And it was really a privilege to interview you. And I'm so, so happy that you're happy. And I wish you nothing but the very best.
Thank you so very much, Kevin. And just let me say how important this work is that you're doing. And I really applaud and appreciate your efforts and all of your associates with Mormon Stories. And it's a wonderful effort. And just keep up the good work. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Curtis. And thank you to our listeners, Gay Mormon Stories. Until we talk again, be well, be whole, and be good. We'll talk with you next time. Take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.
My view, the stranger star.